I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We are once again joined by the Secretary of the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development, Ray Skinner. Very good to see you in our studios once again.
Mark, I'm delighted to be here, as always.
Might as well just move in. So one of the things that's interesting is that the HUD in Washington, Housing and Urban Development, has given Maryland $40 million in helping homeowners who are going through temporary economic hardship stay in their homes. Now, tell me how you're using this money and what are you doing and what is this program? What is it called? The Emergency Mortgage Assistance Program?
Yes. As you know, Mark, the recession has really taken its toll on Maryland families, and many find themselves either out of work completely or their hours have been cut back. And if you don't have a job, you can't pay a mortgage, even if we're able to modify the loan and reduce the overall payment and so forth. If you don't have a job, then that really doesn't matter. So the Obama administration has come up with a new program, which is designed to help homeowners who are facing foreclosure due to an economic hardship. They're unemployed, they're underemployed, or they could have a medical condition or medical emergency, which would entitle them to be a part of this program. Believe it or not, this program was authorized under the Wall Street Reform Act, I think it's called the Frank Dodd Financial Reform Act,
right,
that was passed back in the fall to regulate the financial companies. But tucked in that large bill, was this one program, which is called the Emergency Mortgage Assistance Program. And this program will allow us to provide financial assistance to homeowners who are facing foreclosure, including helping them to catch up on arrearages. They may be 3 or 4 months behind.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll be able to help them catch up, as well as going forward, we'll be able to pay a portion of their mortgage for up to 24 months while they're working on looking for a job and getting themselves into a better overall situation. And this is not free money. Now, this is a loan. It's done in the form of a loan to the homeowner, which does not have to be paid back. It's a deferred loan. And if after you finish receiving your assistance for, again, up to 24 months, if you stay in the home for 5 years after that, then the loan is completely forgiven.
So if I'm unemployed and have a mortgage of $1,500 a month and come to you in this new program, what do I get?
Well, first of all, you get counseling. You'll be able to talk to one of our housing counselors who will evaluate your situation, make sure that you're eligible for the program. In order to be eligible, you must be involuntarily unemployed or underemployed due to economic conditions or have a medical condition or medical emergency. You must be at least 3 months behind in your mortgage, and your lender must have actually filed for foreclosure. There's also an income limit associated with this program, which is 120% of the area median income, which for the Baltimore area, I believe the median income is a little over $80,000. So that's pretty high for this area in terms of being eligible. So the counselor will help you to figure out what you're eligible for, what payment you can make, and we will make up the difference, or the program will make up the difference between what you can pay at 31% of your income and what your mortgage payment is.
It's the same hotline number you call?
It's the same hotline number, 1-877-462-7555, or you can go to our website, www.mdhope.org.
Don't lose your home. If you're hot water, lost your job, call that number.
Call that number, 1-877-462-7555.
Ray Skinner, Secretary of Housing and Community Development, thank you so much once again.
Thank you, Mark.
Take care. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We are about to have a conversation with Dr. Michio Kaku, who is Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City University of New York. Of course, he's the co-founder of String Field Theory, and this is his latest work, Physics of the Future, How Science Will Shape Human Destiny and Our Daily Lives by the Year 2100. And Dr. Michio Kaku, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Glad to be on your show.
So where to begin? There's so much here that you have put before us. Let's just talk today. I was telling, as I told you, when I woke up this morning, I started reading about Japan shutting down its reactors, and Stephen Hawking's talking about his book. It made me think immediately of all the things I read again and reread last night in preparation for this. And when you see all these nuclear reactors having the issues that New York Times reported last week around our country and now Japan shutting down its reactor, I wonder how you feel that fits into our future. I mean, you talk a lot about the possibilities of future energy in this book. But I wonder what you think that portends for where we are actually going to go.
Yeah, well, you know, predictions, you have to be very careful.
Yes.
for my book, Physics of the Future, I interviewed 300
yes.
of the world's top scientists to get the best projection of the future. Now, remember that back in the 1950s, there was so much optimism about nuclear energy. We thought that we would have 1,000 reactors in the United States by the year 2000.
Right.
And 1,000 breeder reactors, which is the hard nuclear option, by the year 2000. Now we only have 100. And Japan, as you mentioned, because of the Fukushima disaster, is scaling back and actually shutting down the Hamaoka plant, which is actually near Mount Fuji, which is near a very populated area. If that reactor were to blow, you're talking about affecting a huge chunk of the Japanese population. And I think the lesson here is you have to rely not on predictions from just one group like an industry. You have to look at all possible interviews from all possible points of view. Back in the 50s, it was only the industry making these super optimistic predictions for the future. The critics were never interviewed by the press. I tried to get a balanced viewpoint, looking at all sides by interviewing 300 of the world's top scientists who are inventing the future in their laboratories. So hopefully my book will give a more accurate projection of the next 50 to 100 years rather than one particular point of view.
Now, one of the things that is really interesting about the book that you wrote is that, as you just said, you interviewed hundreds of scientists. So their predictions, their sense of where the future might be, are really based on prototypes that they're already creating, that already exist.
That's right. So, for example, in science fiction, sometimes you read about the internet in your contact lens.
Right.
So you blink and you go online. Actually, there are scientists working on prototypes of these contact lenses. And so you simply blink, and when you look at a person, the contact lens identifies who that person is and prints out their biography right next to the image. So at a cocktail party, you'll know exactly who you have to suck up to at any cocktail party. And also, if they speak Chinese to you, the contact lens will translate Chinese into English and give you subtitles. Google is working on this already. Subtitles from Chinese to English and back as you talk to somebody in a different language. Now, the first people to line up to buy these internet contact lenses will be college students studying for final examinations. They will essentially blink and see all the answers appear on their contact lens. And the second people to buy these internet contact lenses will be artists, architects, creative people who want to wave their hand and create beautiful images and redraw certain diagrams simply by waving their fingers. So that's the way the future is going to be. It's going to be sort of like the movie The Matrix or the holodeck on Star Trek. You'll be able to conjure up new worlds, manipulate pieces of art, be a tourist and see the entire Roman Empire resurrected for you in your contact lens. It's going to be quite a wild ride when we have the entire internet right in your contact lens.
Now, one of the things I thought about in looking at that, I mean, when you were writing about that, I mean, this world of our future that could become very kind of, as you said, explosive. The question is, is it the future that you know, where we have these artificial intelligences around us? Will it be like, from your perspective, like the Terminator, which can be a very negative aspect of that future, or will it be like Kurzweil's ideas about this friendly artificial intelligence, this friendly kind of technology? I mean, it can go either way.
I can go either way. However, take a look at the Internet. The Internet was originally created as a war-fighting, domineering device to fight a nuclear war with the Soviet Union. now the internet is about touching people. It's about reaching out, Facebook, Twitter. Look at what it has done to the Middle East. It's changed the whole political landscape of the Middle East. And so we're talking about science being democratizing, science being liberating. And the Terminator robot, I think, is not for maybe late in the 21st century. Our robots today are quite primitive. Our robots today have the intelligence of a cockroach. You see some of our most advanced robots in Japan right now going into the reactor. They're like cockroaches slowly peering into the radiation field of the reactor, not doing anything, not making any repairs. And when the Watson computer beat those two humans on Jeopardy, the media said that, the robots are going to put us in zoos, and they're going to throw peanuts at us and make us dance behind bars. Well, the Watson computer was so stupid that it didn't even know that it won the Jeopardy contest. It was that dumb. And so we realized that computers have a long ways to go before they can even begin to mimic true human intelligence.
Now, someone said about that, I'm curious what you think about this, and as I was reading your book, that someone once posited on this program that that artificial intelligence will never really mimic, reach, or be like human intelligence until, you know how we have these computer games that can like beat a chess master. But it will never reach who we are until it comes to the point where it can beat a Go master.
Well, look at it this way. I think that computers can do one-trick ponies, one trick really well. And it'll take many, many decades to put all these tricks together to get a composite machine that can begin to mimic human behavior. Now, your adding machine in your cell phone, that adding machine can add about a million times faster than you can.
Right.
But we don't have a nervous breakdown contemplating we have a super genius right there on our belt. We don't have a nervous breakdown because we know that it's a one-trick pony. That's all it can do. And most of our robots, that's all they can do, one trick at a time. Look at the battlefield in Iraq or Afghanistan. The military is throwing in some of our most advanced robots. And as you can clearly see, all they can do is sniff out bombs in the road, like a cockroach sniffing out food. And so we have a long ways to go before we have robots like in Star Trek or Star Wars. That, I think, is for late in the 21st century.
So what did you think of that analogy? Do you think that is the complexity of a game like Go is something that would be analogous to the complexity of the human mind as opposed to...
No, I think the human mind is much more complicated than a game. You see, we already have chess-playing machines that can beat a chess master.
Right.
And eventually we'll have machines that can beat a Go master as well. But humans have the ability to learn new tasks, a variety of tasks. You see, our brain is not really a computer. For the last 50 years, we were on the wrong trail, thinking that our brain was a digital computer.
Right.
But the brain has no software, no Windows, no programming, no CPU, no Pentium chip. The brain doesn't have any of the characteristics of a digital computer. The brain is a learning machine. It's a neural network. It rewires itself after learning every task. And that's why we realized that the brain is much more sophisticated than we thought. It's a learning machine. All it does, like a baby, all it does is learn. But your laptop today is just as stupid as it was yesterday and will be just as stupid as it is tomorrow because it never learns anything at all.
So when you talk about the early part of your book, the internet, you know, our contact lenses and what it will be able to do, it made me think again this morning of the article I was reading about Stephen Hawking in the New York Times where he communicates with his computer to write by just a twitch of his cheek.
That's right. It's very sad. I met him last year in New York City, uh-huh. And he's at the point where he can basically blink and grimace with his cheek muscles, and that's about it. That's all Stephen can do now. However, we now can hook up the brain directly to a computer. This was done at Brown University with a stroke victim who is totally paralyzed, just like Stephen Hawking. And they put a chip on top of his brain, hooked the chip to a laptop. And this person can now surf the web, do video games, do crossword puzzles, write emails, answer emails, just like you and me. So when I met Stephen Hawking, I looked at the audience, and in the audience was John Donahue, the very same doctor who is pioneering at Brown University mind-brain interface. So I think there is some talk that at some point when Stephen loses control of his blinking muscles, that we may want to hook his brain directly to a laptop computer so that he can communicate without having to go through his muscles and the voice box. And, you know, again, most of his muscles don't work anymore because he's basically paralyzed.
Right.
So I think that's one way to keep him going and still have him communicate with the world. And this is, by the way, is how we are going to communicate with the world in the future. In the future, we're simply going to think, and our wishes will be carried out. Sensors in our room will pick up the radio from our brain. Our brain does emit radio, decipher the signals of the radio, and then carry out our wishes. And so at night, for example, when you come home, you go in your game room, you'll be surrounded by 360 degrees of intelligent wallpaper. The wallpaper itself will be intelligent. You'll communicate with it with mentally, and you'll conjure up any world, any science fiction fantasy, any scene from the past or the future. You'll be able to mentally do this, just like in the movies, like the holodeck in Star Trek and the movie The Matrix.
So talk about how you think that this will be... I mean, this technology, the way that you write about it, you talk about it as a technology that will actually make material wealth widespread. That you talk about, especially your chapter on nanotechnology,
right?
And that we will program this. And I explain this, how this will work. I mean, how will programming the molecular assembly powered by sunlight will make material wealth widespread? You write about it. Now talk about that.
Yeah,
what does that mean?
Let's talk about nanotechnology,
yeah.
The use of tiny molecular machines. At the very simplest level, we will have nanomachines in our bathroom, in our toilet. So when we use our toilet, DNA scans in the toilet will pick up proteins emitted from a cancer colony of 100 cancerous cells 10 years before a tumor forms. So the word tumor could literally disappear from the English language. Complements of nanosensors in your toilet. And then we have nanomolecules called nanoparticles, and they actually home in on cancer cells. This is a technology that in one trial killed 90% of the cancer cells in a tumor. This is like a smart bomb, a smart molecule that actively seeks out cancer and kills it on contact. This is not science fiction now. We already have these DNA chips that will one day be in your toilet, making the word tumor disappear from the English language. And we already have prototypes of these nanoparticles, which in one study killed 90% of the cancer cells in a tumor. So the simplest application of nanotechnology will be in our bathroom when we have sensors that can eliminate cancer.
And you think that technology can be widespread and made available to the world, to the public, just like this the fellow that was in the end of your book, this guy you created who lived in New York working on plugging the dikes that will be saving New York because global warming is here. It's not going to be stopped.
Right. It turns out that initially, whenever technologies are made, they're expensive. That's why some people fear the digital divide. But, you know, computers get cheaper by half every 18 months. And so that means that the digital divide never materialized. In fact, kids, teenagers, elementary school kids, they're all online now. If you're not online, what's wrong with you? There's enormous pressure on children to get a handle, get online, and communicate on Facebook and Twitter. So the digital divide never materialized. The problem is jobs. Of course, the job market will change enormously because of this, but the digital divide never materialized. And the same thing with all these medical miracles. We will, for example, we'll be able to grow organs of the body from your own cells as they wear out. Initially, they'll be expensive, but the price will drop because computer technology gets cheaper every year. At the present time, from your own cells, we can grow cartilage, noses, ears, blood vessels, skin. The first heart valve was grown a few years ago. The first bladder was grown 4 years ago. And in 5 years' time, the first liver will be grown. So for all you alcoholics out there, take heart. We will grow new livers. Mickey Mantle died of liver failure.
Yes.
You know, the Yankee star? In the future, somebody like him will not have to die because we will grow livers from your own cells.
So you have an interesting little piece in here, a quote towards the end of your book, where you say, in the past, people said the pen was mightier than the sword. In the future, it will be the chip that is mightier than the sword.
That's right. The chip, as I mentioned, is already changing the political landscape of the Middle East. Dictators are falling in the Middle East, dictators that have been there for 50 years, because the chip is spreading knowledge. And realize that in history, no two democracies have ever warred with each other. Think of every single war that you learned about since you were in grade school. Every one was between dictatorships and monarchies, but never between two democracies. And so as the Internet and Facebook and Twitter spread democracy around the world, it lessens the fires for war. So I think democracy is a great thing because, you know, democracies never war with other democracies. And so science has this unintended consequence of spreading democracy. And in a democracy, people don't want to kill each other. They want to get rich. They want to have a good life for their kids. That's what people want when countries become democratic.
Now, you, again, let me just kind of, this is, I was thinking of what you just said, and I was thinking about, again, in the same chapter of your book, when you write that, let me just, these couple of paragraphs, and how you think this will play out. I mean, you write, but science by itself is morally neutral. Science is like a double-edged sword. One side of the sword can cut against poverty, disease, and ignorance, but the other side of the sword can cut against people. How this mighty sword is wielded depends on the wisdom of its handlers, and as Einstein once said, science can only determine what is, but not what shall be, and beyond its realm, value judgments remain indispensable. Science solves some problems only to create others, but on a higher level. So while all this is open, it's also open to question.
That's right. So let's say, for example, biotechnology. It has the capability of lengthening the human lifespan. Biotechnology allows us to isolate many of the genes that control the aging process. This is big. Our grandkids may have the ability, when they hit the age of 30, to simply stop aging and simply stay at age 30 for many decades. But biotechnology also has a dark side. Some dictatorship in the future may weaponize the AIDS virus and make it airborne. If the AIDS virus becomes airborne, then you sneeze and you kill somebody. So that could literally wipe out 98% of the human race that is vulnerable to HIV. So it's something to worry about, that the potential for this technology is the potential to lengthen the human lifespan or to perhaps even wipe out the human race if somebody weaponizes the Ebola virus or the AIDS virus. Something to think about.
So you're positing really in some ways that you think we are about to enter one of these epic changes in humankind.
That's right. I think we're about to enter what we physicists call a Type 1 civilization. When we physicists look in outer space for intelligent beings, we don't look for little green men. We look for Type 1, Type 2, and Type 3 civilizations.
Yeah, describe those.
Yeah, a Type 1 civilization is something like the world of Buck Rogers or Flash Gordon. They're planetary. They control the weather. They control hurricanes and earthquakes. That's the Type 1 civilization. A Type 2 expands out and controls stars. They play with stars like Star Trek. The Federation of Planets has colonized a few star systems. They're a typical Type 2 civilization. And then we have galactic civilizations like the Empire of the Empire Strikes Back or the Borg of Star Trek, a galactic spacefaring civilization that cuts across the galaxy. Now, on this scale, what are we? Do we play with hurricanes and tornadoes? Do we play with stars? Do we play with galaxies? No, we are Type Zero. We get our energy from dead plants, oil and coal. But we are about 100 years away from becoming Type 1. So, for example, what is the Internet? The Internet is basically a Type 1 telephone system. What is English? English is the language of a future Type 1 civilization. English is already the number one second language on the planet Earth. It's the number one language on the Internet. And what is the European Union? The beginning of a type 1 economy, NAFTA, the European Union, trade blocs, gigantic trade areas around the world. That's the economy of the future. And what is the Olympics and soccer, the beginning of a planetary sport? And what is rock and roll? Rock and roll is the beginning of a planetary culture, youth culture. And so we're seeing the birth pangs of a type 1 civilization. But then there are people who don't like a type 1 civilization, the terrorists, people like Osama bin Laden. They feel more comfortable living in the year 1000 A.D. rather than in the year 2100 A.D.
So there are also, though, as you even write about, I mean, the battles over where language, when you talk about the contradictions, I mean, there were battles over where language will go. You have English, you have Chinese, you can throw Spanish into the mix, maybe Arabic, as languages of the future. Other people are battling to save their languages, and you posit that, well, our new technology can save the dying languages. People are concerned about being kind of homogenized on the planet. And then on the other, you talk briefly about food production, how we can feed the world. That's not going to be an issue. But others are saying, no, if we want to feed the world correctly, it has to be sustainable and local, not global. Because it's unhealthy the way we're doing it in terms of a global sense. So what about those contradictions?
Yeah, if you take a look at food, for example, commodity prices in general have fallen over the centuries. This morning you had breakfast that the King of England could not have had 100 years ago.
Right.
All the delicacies from around the world. And the economy is switching away from commodity capital more toward intellectual capital. More toward Hollywood movies, software, novels, creative endeavors, things that robots and things that computers cannot do. And so more and more, we're going to go away from commodities. For example, Tony Blair of England liked to say that England derives more revenue from rock music than it does the coal industry. But when you think of a British worker, you think of a coal miner, but yet rock and roll generates more revenue for England than the coal industry. So you have to realize that the world economy is also changing. And in the book, Physics of the Future, I lay out the jobs which are going to flourish in the future and the jobs which are going to be obliterated in the future. We no longer have blacksmiths. We no longer have wagon makers. And the world is actually better for the fact that we don't have blacksmiths and wagon makers. So in the book, I lay out the future jobs which are going to flourish and the future jobs which are doomed in the future.
But going back to the fear that many people have about a homogenized world and all of this.
Uh-huh.
I mean, how do we address
that? Yeah, here's how it works. Right now, if you go overseas to meet the educated people, they're bilingual. They speak English, that is a planetary language, but they also speak the local language. That's going to be the paradigm for a type 1 civilization. We're going to be bicultural. On one hand, we'll have a planetary culture, you know, rock and roll, Chanel, Gucci bags, reality TV. We'll have a global culture, but also a local culture. And so we'll be bicultural. These local cultures will live forever. Languages that are dying out, they'll be encoded in the Internet, and they'll live forever. Even though only one or two people may speak these dying languages, the languages will be recorded on the Internet and live forever. But on the other hand, in addition to being locally fluent in the local language, people will be fluent in the global language of rock and roll, the global language of Hollywood blockbuster movies. And so people will freely go back between the planetary culture and the local culture. So don't fear that local cultures are going to get wiped out. Local cultures will live forever on the Internet. However, the global culture will lessen war because wars are easier to get started if you don't know who the enemy is. But right now, realize that kids, teenagers, think nothing of playing video games with somebody in Russia, Australia, Alaska. They think nothing of that. They may have more in common with somebody in Borneo than their next-door neighbor. And so I think the Internet is leveling the playing field and making it much easier to create a planetary culture which will exist simultaneously with local cultures.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show, Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines, where you can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City University of New York. Of course, he's the co-founder of string field theory, and this is his latest work, Physics of the Future, How Science Will Shape Human Destiny and Our Daily Lives by the Year 2100. So talk a bit about the theories you wrote down and the people you've interviewed when you talked about the future of energy. And that we clearly are not going to stop the greenhouse effect. It's already moving ahead. That I think you posit that 11% of the entire population will be displaced if sea levels rise by 3 feet in the next 50 years. But you also have a very optimistic view of where it might take us. So talk about that a minute.
Yeah, well, global warming is a pretty nasty subject. I live in Manhattan, and yes, in the future, Manhattan may be underwater, so we may have to build dikes around some of our great cities to keep them from being inundated by the rising of sea level. However, I also think that global warming is only a problem for the next few decades, not the whole century. If you take a look at solar power today is about twice as expensive as fossil fuels. However, they are dropping dramatically in price. So within about 10 years, the rising cost of gasoline and coal will collide with the falling price of solar, and when the two curves intersect, that's when solar power becomes competitive in the marketplace with coal and with fossil fuels, and then we could enter the solar era by 2020. And then by 2030, another option opens up, and that is fusion power. Fusion power is being developed by the French and the European Union, also the United States, and fusion power is power from the sun. That is using seawater, the hydrogen of seawater, to energize plants that create almost no nuclear waste at all. What is devastating Japan today is the nuclear waste created by the fissioning of uranium, which creates an enormous amount of debris, and that debris is getting into people's milk, getting into people's vegetables and foods and shrimp. That's what's causing problems in Japan right now, the nuclear waste from a reactor accident. But fusion power creates no nuclear waste other than helium gas, which is actually commercially valuable. So I think in 10 years we'll hit a solar era, and roughly 20 years maybe a fusion era.
I mean, I found that you're in your chapter on the future of energy that your part that the segment on fusion power was really fascinating. I mean, that you really do posit in here that. You believe that fusion power, that we're on the way to making that work. There's been so much debate and speculation that fusion power is just a mythology, that we can't ever get to the place where it's going to work. But you think very differently about that.
That's right. I think we're finally turning the corner. Fusion used to be the butt of jokes.
Right.
People used to joke that every 20 years they predict that we'll have fusion power in 20 years. Then 20 years comes and goes, and we still don't have fusion. However, this time I think we physicists have finally paid our dues. The next reactor, the ITER fusion reactor in southern France,
right.
That fusion reactor is specifically designed to break even, specifically designed to generate more energy than it consumes. And that's a first. We've never had a fusion plant specifically designed to be a net generator of power. Commercialization takes 10 more years, and so in 20 years' time, we could have the first commercial fusion reactors providing power.
So if you think that's true, the whole idea of what they're working on, which you just described, the International Thermonuclear Experimental Reactor in France that you were just describing, with these huge magnetic fields trying to contain hydrogen gas, as you wrote about. Where are we with that right now? And what makes you think that we can actually reach the place you're talking about?
Okay. Well, why does the sun shine? The sun shines because gravity squeezes hydrogen gas evenly, and hydrogen gas then becomes very hot, and it fuses to create helium gas, releasing energy by Einstein's equation E equals mc squared.
Right.
That's the secret of the stars. That's why stars shine. Now, on Earth, we cannot use gravity to squeeze hydrogen gas because gravity is very weak. We use magnetism instead. But magnetism is quite irregular. Magnetism has two poles, a north pole and a south pole. So to create a magnet which can squeeze gas is really difficult. Think of a balloon, and you try to squeeze a balloon. Every time you squeeze a balloon in one direction, it pops out in another direction. That's the problem with fusion, instability. Every time we try to squeeze the magnetic field to squeeze hydrogen gas, it bulges out the other direction and ruins the whole process. However, I think we have finally turned the corner. After years and years of painful failures, we have finally learned how to squeeze a balloon evenly so that it doesn't pop out the other end. And that's what we hope to do in southern France, where the European Union, Russia, the United States, Japan, and Korea have invested $13 billion to create a machine which will evenly squeeze hydrogen gas with a magnetic field without it bulging out in another direction. This is a first, and it could lead to commercialization of fusion 10 years after that.
So if that's the case, I couldn't help but thinking as I was reading that part of the book, if that's the case, then I, being thinking about the practicality of living right now in 2011 and where we may be for my children and grandchildren as we turn the next century.
Yeah, well, look at the next 10 years or the next 20 years. In the next 10 years, solar power will become cheaper and cheaper. Already, people are trying to buy rights to the Sahara Desert. Europeans are beginning to say, look, let's buy rights to the Sahara Desert so that, not today, but in 5 to 10 years, we'll put solar panels over huge chunks of the desert and provide energy for Europe. And so right now, people realize that solar is twice as expensive as fossil fuels on average, but it's dropping in price. And so if you buy rights to the Sahara Desert, you know that in 5 to 10 years, your investment could have huge dividends, because then most people will have bought up rights to the deserts around the world. So even in the United States now, people are looking very seriously at looking for desert rights in the United States, preparing for the time when solar power becomes fully competitive with fossil fuels.
So what does that say about what we, both in terms of private investment, but also in terms of where the government invests? Because no great change in any technology has ever taken place in this country or in Europe or anyplace else without, as they're doing in China now, without massive government investment. And then the creative minds of the private world take over with that investment and build. So the danger, it seems, though, is that we are not thinking about where to invest publicly now to build for this future you're talking about.
Right. Very sadly, all the subsidies are going into the nuclear option. Realize that the nuclear fuel cycle, that is the mining and milling of uranium, is identical for the weapons industry and the commercial industry. Therefore, the taxpayer subsidizes the nuclear energy industry simply because it's so connected with the weapons industry. And as a consequence, nuclear power is subsidized by the federal government. Also, by the way, nuclear power is subsidized by the government in terms of insurance. No insurance company will ever insure a nuclear power plant. Look what happened to Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, or Fukushima. However, the United States government guarantees a minimum so that insurance companies will finally insure nuclear power. That's called the Price-Anderson Act. So it took an act of Congress to get the insurance companies to finally insure nuclear power plants, because the insurance companies know that you could wipe out an area about the size of Pennsylvania if a reactor goes berserk. Now, solar has no subsidies. As a consequence, tax credits, tax breaks, little things like that, the government could encourage the development of solar power. But solar power, because it does not have a weapons connection, basically has been the black sheep of the family, has not gotten these massive government subsidies that nuclear energy and oil have gotten over the last several decades, which is rather sad. However, just the ordinary progress of technology is dropping the cost of solar every year. And in about 10 years, it'll be fully competitive with fossil fuels.
Nor do we invest in fusion.
Well, fusion is a little bit different in the sense that the European Union hopes that this will be their shining golden boy. They're really putting the eggs in this basket and hoping that the French ITER fusion reactor will finally attain break-even. And, you know, they're putting up 10 billion euros to prove it.
So let's leap for a moment I forgot his name, but he's talking to Molly and Dr. Brown.
John, right?
John, yes. And,
yeah.
And the world that he lives in New York City, and he's working on these dikes and has an issue to deal with. But it to me, I was really fascinated by the way you ended it, not to give it all away, but you can take this book and read it in chunks. You don't have to read it from beginning to end. That you have this, you know, and I was thinking about where we would be as a culture, as a place, where, you know, he sits, goes to the bathroom, and all of a sudden this is Dr. Brown pops up and tells him, look, you've got these cancer cells growing, so we're going to have to eliminate those and get rid of them. Because you already have this artificial arm when you crashed going down what was left of the Alps. But you really do posit that this is where you think we will be.
Yeah, at the end of the book, I do a little bit of science fiction writing and talk about a typical day in the year 2100 when you wake up and you mentally control everything in the house. You mentally control the robot that cooks your food. You mentally control the car. You tell the car to get activated. The car is a flying car, and you tell the car to come to your doorstep to get ready. And if you are an engineer, and you're worried about the fact that Manhattan has dikes, huge dikes around it to protect it, and that's what your job is, you go in your flying car, you go to work, and you go to a meeting, and there's nobody there in the meeting hall. But over the next few seconds, images materialize, because in your contact lens, you will see images of all the people in your company materializing one by one, either holographically or in your contact lens. And when they do a slideshow presentation, instead of a two-dimensional flat slideshow presentation, it's like three-dimensional. It's like being in a planetarium. You're surrounded by images. So PowerPoint slide presentations of the future will be fully three-dimensional, animated, and you simply wave your hands and alter the image. And then dating is going to be much more difficult because we'll be able to slow down the aging process. You will really not know quite how old your date is anymore because from the scientists that I've interviewed, we will be able to slow down the aging process and perhaps reach the age of 30, if you like the age of 30, and coast for several decades at the age of 30. So when you meet somebody on a blind date, you really won't know how old that person is. And your doctor, in order to reduce medical care costs, you'll simply talk to the wall screen in your wall, because wallpaper is intelligent, and a doctor will materialize who looks like a real doctor, talks like a real doctor, but is a software program. And the software program can answer, you know, 95, 99% of all your questions with incredible accuracy. And that's going to tremendously reduce healthcare costs. And it's also going to make possible house visits by doctors because you'll always have a robo-doc in your wall screen.
And do you think, just as we conclude here in this really fascinating conversation we're having here with Dr. Michio Kaku about his book, Physics of the Future, I mean, what about the social consequences and how we change as human beings with what you're positing here?
Okay, well, yes, the human being itself will change. And, oh, by the way, I should also mention that the book has been on the New York Times bestseller
list
for 5 weeks running now.
And as it should be.
right? And a lot of people are curious about the future, not as told by a science fiction writer, but as told by the scientists who are building the future. And yes, society itself may begin to change. By the end of the century, we're going to get used to the fact that there will be robots. They're not going to be as smart as us, I don't think. But we will live in a world where we'll have robot helpers, robot cooks, robot butlers, robot chauffeurs. Cars will drive themselves. Food will cook by itself. And we'll just have to get used to that fact. And then, of course, we have to worry about the job market. Factory jobs are going to go out the window, repetitive jobs. All that will be done by robots as they gradually become more intelligent. But then creative jobs, jobs involving artwork, innovation, jobs that involve creativity, leadership, talent, analysis, experience, all those jobs cannot be done by robots. And those jobs are going to flourish, meaning that in some sense we're going to eliminate those horrible coal miner jobs where you have soot all over your hands and the factory work, which in which case you have a lot of factory accidents and people get killed in a machine. Those jobs are going to be gone. But a new set of jobs are going to open up, which will change society totally. So anyway, in the book, Physics of the Future, I list all the jobs that are going to flourish, and some of them are quite surprising. There are quite a few jobs that robots cannot perform, like gardening, for example. A robot gardener is impossible because every flower is different. It takes a sense of aesthetics to create a garden, and robots can't do that. Robots can just barely navigate across the room.
This has been a fascinating conversation, and I'm happy that you kind of brought our attention to all this, but also that you're still, even though you look to the future and are deeply embedded in where science may take our planet in a very positive sense, you can still reach for an old worn book and leave us with Mahatma Gandhi.
Mm-hmm, right. And so, again, the book is called Physics of the Future. It was a delight to make, and I think it's the most authoritative and authentic look at the future by the people who are making it.
Dr. Michio Kaku, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay,
it's been a pleasure. Physics of the Future, a book well worth reading. Thank you so much.
When I was a very young and lonely man, in truth a scared and lonely little boy in young man's clothing, then you walked into my life and gently took my hand, then we began a soulmate's journey.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We're here with Lance Reddick. You know him from The Wire, many other things on TV, but what we didn't know about Lance Reddick, besides the fact that he's a Baltimorean and grew up here, is that he is an incredible singer and musician and has turned to jazz after being taught classical music in his early life. And the CD is called Contemplations and Remembrances, and we're listening to this cut under us called Our Journey. And Lance, let's just talk a bit about this CD and these particulars, and we got some songs that we'll hear as we talk together. Before we talk about Our Journey, well, let's talk about Our Journey. Then I'm going to launch into a bit about how you got into this album.
Okay.
But talk about this particular piece, because each one of these songs is like a standalone philosophical poem.
Well, you want me to talk about Our Journey first?
Yeah.
Well, Our Journey was actually that was kind of my first. Well, not my first. I mean, actually, Time to Say Goodbye was actually my first kind of attempt at writing a kind of a jazz ballad. But Our Journey was, at the time that I wrote Our Journey, we were shooting the first season of The Wire. And at the time, I was listening to, for about 2 years, I was listening to Miles Davis and Herbie Hancock obsessively. And a lot of times I won't know where I'm going to start when I start to write a song. I'll just kind of free write. And Our Journey, aside from Miles Davis, the probably the biggest influence in my songwriting, in both his approach to lyrics and his approach to music, is Sting. Our Journey is really, it's a song about my ex-wife and my relationship with her, and kind of how, it came from kind of two kids, with dreams, and then kind of dealing with reality.
Mm-hmm. You can hear your little girls all through that song.
Say that again?
Your little girl is all through that song.
Yeah. Well, both my kids are.
Both your kids.
Yeah.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, so, And, you know, each, you know, so I tried to, because Sting has been such a huge influence on me, I really, really think of lyrics as poetry. So I try to, it's not that I'm trying to make things complex, but I try to make the lyrics and the music as rich as possible. More often than not, I'll start with the lyrics, and then I'll start working on the music, and then they'll kind of end up finish writing them in tandem.
That's interesting. And you, but these songs do. I mean, they're part of your life, but they're also, it seems, you kind of take a very almost philosophical approach to things. It feels like,
you know, I feel that when I write something, you know, rather than it just being kind of, how do I put this? When I think about kind of the songs that really move me and or the films or performances that really move me, even though I think on the one hand they need to be, they don't always have to be, but generally they're very personal. So it's as though you're listening to or watching, you know, someone's very personal experience. But I think what makes them great is that there's a universal appeal, because at the end of the day, most of us have, you know, as we go through life, we tend to have, you know, the same issues, the same kinds of things that we deal with in life. And it's just a matter of kind of the different spin that life gives us based on our background and the culture that we grew up in.
Let's slide into another cut here, and we can talk about a range of things as we have this conversation here today with Lance Reddick. Of course, you know him from The Wire and many other incredible TV and film performances that he has done. His latest we're talking about here is a CD, a jazz CD, that he's going back to his music roots and the soul of his work in many ways. It's called Contemplations and Remembrances. This is a piece called Hey John, and let's just take a minute or so to hear a bit of this, and we'll come back with Lance.
In the city night, under the glow of a street light that's dim. Pale skin.
So this piece, Hey John, Lance, talk about where this comes from for you, what it's saying to us and to you.
Well, you know, it's interesting because Hey John, if you listen to the lyrics, obviously it's about a prostitute.
Right.
A street walker who, this is not a high call girl who goes to hotels. So this is not somebody who's basically just struggling to, you know, it's like scratching out a living. And honestly, when I started trying to write the song, I started trying to write it from the point of the John. And it just wasn't very interesting. So I thought, well, what if I write it from the point of view of the prostitute? And it got much more interesting to me. And for me, the message more than anything else is that, you know, even though I try to paint a very vivid picture of kind of her experience in the first two verses, when it gets into the bridge, when I feel like it gets to the point of the song, if you want to say that there's this, like a message, and I'm always kind of hesitant to say that there's necessarily a message per se, and it's that, you know, we're all human beings, you know, at the end of the day, you know, we tend to look at each other based on our labels, and those labels have significance based on how we've been programmed by society. But when you strip away the labels, you know, this is a human being who has may have a friend, may have a lover, may have kids, may have dreams, and just kind of ended up here for whatever reason.
Lance Reddick, this has just been a pleasure. Lance Reddick has been talking about his life as an actor, his latest incredible CD, Contemplations and Remembrances. As we finish the conversation, you've been hearing a cut number 5 on the CD, Voice, which is just an amazing cut. And I can't wait to see what comes out musically and also theatrically in your life, Lance Reddick. Thank you so much for taking the time for us today.
Oh, thank you, Mark. It's been a real pleasure.
There's scraping and there's clattering.